Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We've taken our consideration of geopolitics up to the end of the Cold War, and that therefore means we have to move into the 1990s. Now, it's very easy to use these kind of automatic historical building blocks and boundaries and divides. And of course, they might work for some areas, they don't necessarily work for all. But in terms of the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union, which were the two great powers of the period, the end of the Cold War was extraordinarily important because it saw the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And indeed, a very significant loss of territory, population, and military capacity. Now, this was not and isn't comparable to what occurred in terms of the earlier disasters of Soviet history, namely the Civil War and the German invasion of 1941. And you know, Vladimir Putin's attempt to present it as a geopolitical catastrophe should be put very much in question marks, because of course the dissolution of the Soviet Union represented the democratic will of a large number of people, particularly in the Baltics and Ukraine, less so in Central Asia, where there was the dissolution of the Soviet Union was a more authoritarian process, and the Soviet Union was replaced by more authoritarian governments. But it seems a little harsh to say that one's in favour of democracy, one's in favour of liberty. But by the way, that wasn't appropriate for Latvia or Lithuania or Estonia or Ukraine or the others. Anyway, there was clearly a change, and the change forced a major process of rethinking in what had been the Soviet Union. Not only that there were a whole host of new states which had to consider their position, not least in the face of the danger of a kind of Russian expansionism or even Soviet revanchism, but also it forced the need for what was Russia to think about its position. However, what we're going to do is look at the United States, because the United States in the 1990s has been described in terms of a hyperpower. It's been, and as it were, something that surpasses the ordinary and prior superpowers, because now there was apparently just one as opposed to two. And this has been seen as ushering in a position which was then challenged, to use the word of our days, and to a degree fragmented or even lessened by what happens the events of more recent times, whether you think they are good or bad. But let's go back to the beginning of the 90s, because at the beginning of the 90s, nobody actually had the situation of believing that there would necessarily be a rapid dissolution of the American hegemony or American strength, whatever one wants to call it. And certainly there was no reason to believe that that would be comparable to what had happening to the Soviet Union, not least because the fall of the Soviet Union was very much given a amplitude by the Gulf War of 1990-1991. In 1990, Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, invaded Kuwait, a pro-Western state and major oil producer. Saddam Hussein, in part, doing so in order to try and compensate for the financial and other losses that he'd incurred, prestige losses, in his unsuccessful attack on Iran and the subsequent war that had been there between 1980 and 1988, in part pursuing Iraqi ambitions towards Kuwait, which had been seen on in earlier episodes, such as intimidation in 1961, and in part, apparently, believing that there was some degree of green light and that the Americans wouldn't be too bothered about it. Well, that may or may not, the last may or may not have been a factor. It seems rather implausible. But whatever was the case, the riposte from the United States underlined a military potency, which in some respects matched what was going on with reference to the diplomatic hegemony, which we've seen as a result of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The Americans very rapidly reinforced their ally, Saudi Arabia, including dispatching significant military strength to that area, not just Saudi Arabia, but to allied states in the Persian Gulf. I can recall, in fact, I was due to fly to Lisbon. Portuguese airspace was closed because of American supply planes flying eastwards, and therefore my plane had to land at the airport at Santiago. And I can recall, as the plane came in, looking south and seeing several large American military cargo planes going eastwards. But anyway, there was a very rapid riposte. The United States not only had a military riposte, it was able to, as it were, give effect to its diplomatic hegemony by organizing an international coalition, including a number of Arab states, and to lead that in a successful devastation of the Iraqi military and the rapid expulsion of them from Kuwait in 1991. Now, that, if anything, suggested an American hegemony even more immediately, because Iraq had been a protege of the Soviet Union. And if the Soviet Union was not in a position to protect such a major protege, and if Soviet-supplied munitions and military system could be so rapidly and clearly degraded, then there was not much more to say about the idea that there was some process of equality or some idea of whatever one might mean by a deterrence on American action. I mean, these theses were in practice rather foolish. Clearly, the Americans were going to act to protect Saudi Arabia. Clearly, Saddam Hussein had behaved as an aggressive party. And clearly, this represented a need to restrain him. And one would imagine that the Americans would have acted in what in effect was a limited war, a war in which they drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, but did not move forward into Iraq. One could imagine that that in many senses conformed in a way to Cold War, what one might term deterrence. In other words, it was a limited war fought on a restricted timetable and without leading to the overthrow of Iraq and the occupation of Iraq. Now, there's a whole host of reasons were given for that. The stipulations of the coalition and the American wish to take their allies with them, the wish of the administration of President George H.W. Bush to be cautious, and their sense of an uncertainty about what would happen if they tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, which incidentally was to be vindicated with the aftermath of his son, President George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq in 2003. So there's a number of reasons that can be given, but nevertheless, in part, this was actually a demonstration also that the Cold War ethos of limited conflict out of area of the European space continued. Meanwhile, writers, commentators were sharpening their pens in order to provide instant commentary. And what's interesting is that two of the major texts, each of which we're going to look at, originated as what one might call opportunistic articles in the magazine Foreign Affairs, which, you know, is not generally noted for having particularly profound research-based pieces in it, but offered an immediate response, both by political scientists trying to offer a new theorization of what was going on, but obviously based on a very limited empirical evidence base of the situation had only just changed. So they rushed to judgment without really seeing what was going to happen. Francis Fukuyama is noted for, he turned his piece into The End of History and The Last Man, a work which came out in 1992. And he presented the ascendancy of Western liberal democracy as, quote, an end point of history, end of quote, in the shape of an American-centered international order committed to liberal democracy. And as such, the latter provided a context within which those found wanting could be seen as, quote, rogue states, which obviously was a way of defining Iraq, or indeed, as was to be defined, Serbia, or indeed to think of, for example, North Korea. This visualization of a global order left scant room for a geopolitics of spatial division of any form, or other than in terms of progress and its rejection. It was as if geopolitics was thrown away as a method of discrimination because it had been made universal. So that, in a way, is what one could think about. And before we come up to Samuel Huntington, who was the other major one, it's very interesting to note that, in contrast to Fukuyama, an American politician who was an intellectual, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, in his Pandemonium, Ethnicity in International Politics of 1993, emphasized territorial nationalism based on an ethnic consciousness that was not in some way a byproduct of redundant drives. And of course, that made much more sense of the fall of the Soviet ascendancy in Eastern Europe than Fukuyama had done. As a result, Moynihan got the geopolitics of the time more accurate, but he confused ethnicity and nationalism. There are ethnic-based nationalisms, but there are also nationalisms that aren't ethnic-based, not least as the former ethnicity can actually also be divided, for example, by religion, while, of course, the latter can be multi-ethnic. Nationalism can be multi-ethnic. So his had deficiencies, but it was better than Fukuyama. An emphasis on religion was also provided by Samuel P. Huntington, again, an American political scientist, particularly in his The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order, published as a full-length study in 96 and developing arguments in which he had already made in 92 and 93. He proposed that cultural and religious identities and concerns would provide the basis for geopolitical rivalry. This was a rivalry presented as extending across time and space, because obviously if you're thinking about, for example, a tension between Christianity and Islam, you could see that across time back to the 7th century, and you can see it across space. You could see it in all sorts of states, in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, both within states, for example, Sudan or Nigeria, and between states. Now, Huntington was obviously correct to note the role of religious and cultural elements. But as a universal explanation for geopolitics, or for that matter, anything else, war, for example, his account was totally inadequate. Religion made scant sense of divisions in East Asia, particularly between North and South Korea or between China and Japan, unless you're to see leadership cults and governing ideologies as having religious characteristics. President Xi would therefore be presented with his, you know, works, which everybody is supposed to learn, would be presented as a religion. Well, you could do that, and you could argue it's the equivalent of a sort of state religion rather rather like Shinto in Japan, although obviously many Japanese are Buddhists. But I don't think that's tremendously helpful. But, you know, listeners may have a different point of view. Incidentally, from the perspective of a military historian, which is one of my hats, Huntington's thesis was not terribly helpful because, as I've pointed out, in, for example, every 50-year period of the history of Islam, Muslims have killed each other in greater numbers than they've killed non-Muslims. And, you know, and they're not alone among religions in that. In other words, a religion can be a sphere in which people kill each other, particularly because they're concerned to ensure the purity of the religious tradition. They're concerned to ensure orthodoxy, and they're concerned to extirpate the heretic, all of which that can be much more significant than having a go at the pagan, in other words, the person who isn't a member of that religious group. In terms, indeed, of Islam and Christianity, rivalries within the bloc, for example, Shia versus Sunni, which is the usual one given, but in fact is far from exhaustive, or to a lesser extent, Protestant versus Catholic, or even potentially, were we to be looking maybe to the future, liberal theologians versus biblical literalists, could be serious and bloody, or more so than those between blocs. In Iraq and Syria in the 2010s, the Islamic State, IS movement, was to make this bloodily apparent. In turn, the determination of IS to create a theocratic government, a modern caliphate, took precedence over existing national boundaries. As such, IS and similar movements threw a form of geopolitics to the fore in terms of expounding a different basis for a territorial sway, which also influenced the parameters of the response. However you want to see that, what it certainly did not do is necessarily demonstrate the basis of the Huntington approach. The US eventually played a significant role in confronting ISIS, but found it difficult to pursue a consistent policy in the face of what were contrasting political situations in Iraq and Syria, as well as regional partners who had their own views and regarded American inconsistency with considerable wariness. In other words, at one level, you can present this as some form of geopolitical definition of a portion of an area within the Middle East. On the other level, you could say that very specific contrasting political situations, and for that matter, ethnic situations, let us say the Kurds, or however you wish to define the Kurds, actually took precedence over what might be seen as a way to group that situation. American views are of particular consequence when one's looking at geopolitics for the 1990s on, because the range and application of capability by the United States was unprecedented. The US was able to use its transformative military technology to reach everywhere in what was at one level an apogee of air-mindedness. So as people will know, January sees the 120th anniversary of Mackinder with his argument that the age of rail had replaced the Columbian age of sail. I think it's fair to say, and as I've mentioned in an earlier talk, Leo Amery at that very meeting said, well, what about aircraft? I think it's fair to say that by the 1990s, the apogee of air-mindedness seemed very apparent. It was certainly argued very much in terms of the jargon of the period, the revolution in military affairs, or RMA, which was a paradigm shift in capability trumpeted by American commentators in the 1990s and very much believed in. I recall giving a lecture on modern warfare at the Navy Strategy School in Monterey in California. And You know, as my host said to me just before I started, you need to know that the Admiral, the chap in charge here, in other words, really believes in the RMA. In other words, be careful in being a critic of it. And that was very much the way you made your career as a comment. Well, not me, I was awkward, but you made your career as a commentator in the 1990s. Technology was triumphant. There had been a paradigm shift. People then went through the past looking for past alleged paradigm shifts. So you got the build-up of other supposed revolution in military affairs or military revolutions, the alleged one of early modern Europe, for example, trumpeted by Geoffrey Parker, and others that were found in other periods, or allegedly found in other periods, all of which in their own terms were empirically problematic, to put it mildly, as I've tried to show in a number of books. But that didn't matter, because since the investment in the thesis was so strong, and indeed 1,000 conferences, as it were launched, and you would only get your money to go and give these gigs in nice places if you parroted the same old line, it therefore meant that there was a lot invested in it. And indeed, when the RMA became less prominent, it was replaced by another concept called transformation, one in which the US again was in the lead. It was very important to argue that geopolitical constraints of distance, the friction of distance, could be overcome, so that the United States, with a given military force structure, would be able to act around the world. Air power, of course, now had a direct satellite component. I mean, there were changes, and the satellite gives you an ability to provide reconnaissance, which does change the geomilitary situation. And there was real-time reconnaissance, closing the gap between what are known as sensors and firers. And this was seen as having major consequences in what we've already mentioned, the defeat of the Iraqis in 91, and yet again, they're even a quicker defeat in some respects in terms of the greater scale of territory that had to be occupied in 2003. So what was seen as a three-dimensional battlefield came to be argued as being one that was a matter of air power, whereas the three-dimensional battlefield of, shall we say, 1918 was a matter primarily of artillery. Now, mass had its own weight, and has its own weight in military terms, but mass in the 1990s and 2000s was seen increasingly not in the number of troops, but in what were defined as advanced weaponry. And therefore, the geographical scale, capability, and deployment of that weaponry becomes correspondingly more important. In part, this was because of the type of struggle involved. Troop numbers are obviously significant for counterinsurgency struggles, as was to be demonstrated in Iraq after its conquest in 2003. But that had not been the conflict that the United States wished to fight. Indeed, in some respects, the geopolitics of the 1980s, with the idea that the prime requirement of the on the US military would be confrontation, maybe even combat with the Soviet Union, state-on-state warfare, was still very much the desideratum of a lot of military planners and commentators in the United States in the 1990s and early 2000s. So in a sense, it was as if, now I'm not, we're just saying as if they had to find a state to fight, because otherwise, what on earth were you going to be doing with RMA and transformation if you were actually trying to, as it were, chase opponents around a bidonville or the equivalent, a sort of urban slum? Then quite clearly, state-of-the-art aircraft capable of flying several hundred miles an hour are not generally going to help you very much. And indeed, I think you could argue that what we were to see as the failure summarized by the term Iraq, by which one means the resistance that the Americans encountered, and indeed the Brits, of course, in Iraq after its conquest in 2003, conquest unfinished, essentially arose from inadequate pre-war military planning. I mean, I think that's crucial. You get a lot of garbage in military circles about the idea being that the military is always right and civilian politicians are always wrong. And if only the military were allowed to sort things out, everything would work out. Well, look at Iraq in 2003. It was as if American planners, notably the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, believed the propaganda about the RMA. Indeed, in many respects, Rumsfeld was desperate to prove it in action. He took seriously the idea of removing an American physical presence from the Middle East, replacing it with the RMA-inspired plan of what was known as offshore balancing. In other words, what I call force projection. So you don't need to keep your troops there. You don't need the, you know, the grunts on the ground, because you can deliver the lethality accurately and rapidly from a distance. And Rumsfeld wanted to focus entirely on the strategic threat from China, which would again be the state-on-state confrontation, which justified the what you might call the ideology, but let's just call it the theory, the doctrine of American military planning of the early 2000s, and on the force structures and investment policies built in for that. For that to work, for Rumsfeld's focus on China to work, he had to prove that wars could be won in the Middle East with the bare minimum of troops, which, to put it mildly, was a misguided approach. And it's interesting to note that the Israeli government, in acting against the Hamas terrorist movement in Gaza, did not come along with that illusion. They mobilized and deployed very significant numbers of troops because they did not see their undoubted force projection capabilities as enabling them to, as it were, not have a large number of troops on the ground. In addition, Rumsfeld made the classic mistake of propounding attitudes and devising plans that were more appropriate for the military that was readily available. So that in 2003, the American-led coalition was far smaller than in 91, while the US had far fewer forces to deploy, as incidentally also did the Brits, and as it were, picked the plan that went through them with the military, rather than wondering whether the plan was actually viable, and therefore whether he had the force structure that would enable the plan to be executed. Now, aside from justified complaints about systemic hubris, much of the criticism of US war making in recent decades has been focused on the failure to clarify the goals of conflict and thus the political as well as military objectives. The same also, incidentally, has very much been held in discussion about British commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's also been argued in both cases, and for both powers, there was an absence of a clear exit strategy. And indeed, that argument could be made about Israel as far as Gaza is concerned. But I think in Israel's case, and this is very different to the Americans or the British in Iraq or Afghanistan, Iraq and Afghanistan were wars of choice. The Americans did not need to overthrow Saddam Hussein. They did not need to overthrow the Taliban. And they did not then need to maintain a presence. For Israel to have as a neighbor a terrorist organization of murderous intent, such as Hamas, is a very different situation. It is not a war of choice. And a lot of the discussion about ceasefire does not really capture that contrast. Now, the lack of clarity that is seen when people referred, in the case of Iraq, Afghanistan, or anywhere else, to an absence of a clear exit strategy In a sense, one needs to be more understanding of the situation. A lack of clarity is often understandable because one does not know the intentions or determination, resolution or persistence of one's opponent. And that means that the determination to limit the military commitment essentially floats in a set of variables, none of which are fixed. A lack of clarity in part reflects the changeable nature both of circumstances in a zone of conflict and more generally, with this relationship a key element of the prioritization of goals that can challenge any obvious geopolitical exposition. Now, that might sound a little complex. Let me just try and unpick what I mean there. Because circumstances are unclear in any one commitment area, let us say, since we're in the middle of a war involving Israel, Israel in Gaza in part is affected by the uncertainty of what happens in Gaza, not least in terms of the ability to defeat and force will and outcome on Hamas, however defined. But also there is the uncertainty about other potential commitments against Hezbollah, for most prominently, but also a potential new intifada on the West Bank of the Jordan, each of which, because they're uncertain, involve uncertainties of prioritization, and therefore any clear exposition, whether given the language of geopolitics or not, is suspect. You don't know what's going to happen. And you can see a lot of moves in this in these terms. So, for example, we've been talking about Iraq and Afghanistan. The withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021 can be seen primarily in terms of a failed policy in Afghanistan. That's one way of looking at it, and the Americans resolving it. Another way to look at it is to say, actually, what was going on in Afghanistan by 2021 was of minor consequence, given the developing potential for crisis, definitely with China over Taiwan and possibly with North Korea. And therefore, irrespective of circumstances in Afghanistan, it was necessary for the Americans to, as it were, implement a prioritization that shifted military assets elsewhere. Now, it could be that both are correct. You don't have to have an either or. But what you do have to be able to do is to be able to work with these potential circumstances. Now, what I'm going to do is go back to the 1990s next week. We're going to look in particular at the Bosnia and Kosovo crises, and we're going to look at Somalia and peacekeeping. But I think we've sort of established some of the major parameters of the ideas of the 1990s. And I wonder, Graham, whether you've got any particular comments you'd like to make.
Well, I do thank you very much, Jeremy. We will discuss the role of air power in the Bosnian and Kosovan wars next time. So I don't want to get ahead of ourselves by discussing that. But I wonder what your interpretation would be in terms of the first Gulf War, the liberation of Kuwait, in terms of the interpretation by United States and other Western powers and thinkers that that was won by air power and that the on-the-ground operations were really kind of mopping up operations, just making the most of the territorial gains that air power had effectively achieved. Do you think that interpretation of how that conflict was fought has proven to be accurate or not?
Well, I think that's an interesting, very interesting one. I mean, obviously, in a sense, I mean, for, you know, a desert is not an equal, it's not an isotropic surface. You know, an isotropic surface is one which is equal in every part. It's very tempting to think of a sand flatness in those terms, but actually deserts have all sorts of detailed topographical contrasts and also very different goings, which is the technical term for their ability to support armor. But the key point is that deserts are much more exposed to air power, and the targets in them, which in this case in 1991 and indeed in 2003 were particularly tanks, are much more vulnerable as a contrast, not just incidentally to air power, but also to other tanks and also to artillery pieces. So as a result, you can deliver a response in terms of success relatively quickly. I mean, if you think about the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, in the 1967 Sinai campaign, the IDF was then a really good tank-killing force. There's no doubt about its morale and its aptitude, but also it was helped by the terrain. Now, that, of course, did not establish a general proposition about the necessary effectiveness of air power. Now, as you may know, I've written a history of air power. And what I would argue, I have argued, is the Kosovo campaign of 99 showed how very difficult it was in different terrain, very steep valleys with a high degree of tree cover, to actually identify and engage targets. That's point one. And more generally, I've argued in my book on air power that the rising cost in real terms, both of aircraft and of the munitions they carried, particularly guided or smart bombs or rockets, helped to make that form of air power not so much obsolescent, but affected its value. Now, this may be changing dramatically in the case of drones, but with the creation of drones, what we don't know yet is how effective anti-drone techniques are going to be, whether in terms of direct fire or whether in terms of jamming of some sort of system or other. So at the moment, everybody is gung-ho for yet another military revolution. I would say jury still out before we take that much, much further.
And again, thinking specifically about the liberation of Kuwait, was that almost like a high point? You were talking about the RMA. Is that a high point of believing that air power in terms of planes delivering missiles as distinct from missiles fired from ground? I mean, I'm thinking of the perceived failure of Saddam's Scud missiles, at least some of which were shot down and others of which failed. Was this like a moment when missile technology was seen almost to be the past rather than the future? Was this just a short period of time when the plane was seen as the fundamental form of striking from the skies?
No, because planes, aircraft fire missiles. Mm. I mean, missiles are a crucial thing of what is fired from aircraft. I mean, missiles operate at a whole series of different ranges, let alone payload and, you know, speed and all the rest of it. And I mean, at the present moment, the major form of intercontinental lethality comes in the form of missiles. The major, though not the only, delivery method for atomic or thermonuclear weaponry is missiles. I wouldn't say missiles have become obsolescent at all. I would argue that, like any weapons and any weapon system, and incidentally any platform, the platform is where the weapon comes from, all of them are subject to different forms of friction in their usage, and also they're subject to the development and deployment of anti-weapon systems or anti-platform systems by opposing forces. so that, as it were, there is a continual, you know, one could use the term dialectic, but I hope nobody's going to suggest I'm a Hegelian neo-Marxist. But you could argue there's some form, I mean, and, you know, some of the cruder and rather simplistic work on military revolutions operates using dialectical language. I think what I would say is it's not that clear cut to actually vindicate such language, that it's much more chaotic.
I wonder whether this period of revolution and military affairs, so-called, had something to do with some of the issues that Fukuyama and Moynihan and Huntington were raising in terms of their perception of whether it was a future of conflict on ideological grounds or ethnic or national or religious. They nonetheless envisaged what was essentially a dominant United States against second or third rate entities. So an asymmetric warfare in which essentially only one side, the American led side, would have the superior air power. Was that therefore central to the way in which the geopolitical thinkers and the military thinkers found themselves coalescing on the same assumptions?
Yes, I think it is interesting. And one of the reasons I made the point, and I'm glad you've raised it, is that there is often a tendency to think in silo terms, to use a phrase that's been often advanced in academic circles with reference to, you know, big science. I think silo also can be seen very much in social sciences. And because a lot of military discussion is more empirically based, it often implicitly draws on terms that are in general circulation, the terms themselves often being highly dubious and very, very flawed, but they then serve the purpose. I mean, you know, you might say to me, because I've spent a lot, I've written again critically about the notion of the military revolution ever since the beginning of the 1990s. And one of the points I've made is that the term, although clearly very, very weak, and I would argue conceptually bogus and empirically flawed, nevertheless has enormous sticking power. Why does it have enormous sticking power? Because a lot of people want to have some simple concept to play around with, because it then can be used as the sort of intellectual sticking plaster if they're involved in other topics. So most historians don't want to write about war. It's difficult for them. They're interested more in social affairs, or cultural history, or whatever. But they often feel they need to have some sort of overarching, you know, sort of brief discussion about war. So the military revolution, the idea of modernization through technology, provides a universal catch-all for them. Again, most military writers, military historians, military commentators are primarily interested in operational and tactical level. They're interested in the campaign or the leader, the tank or the weapon. They're not really fundamentally interested in the development and complexity of military systems as a whole. So again, it's useful to have some simplistic tool, and again, a military revolution provides that. And what I'm trying to say is this is too important a subject to leave to the shallow thinkers and shallow thoughts.
Well, we will leave off the shallow thinkers and shallow thoughts for now. Jeremy Black, next time we will talk about the wars in the former Yugoslavia and beyond and the consequences for geopolitics there. But for now, thank you very much indeed.
Okay. Okie dokie.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.